Hello and welcome to episode 83 of the Nerds Assemble podcast. I'm Emily.
I'm Paul.
I'm Paul, aka Retroid.
Unfortunately, we've got no cookie this week, but that's okay because there's stuff. As ever, you can find the show notes for this episode over at www.nerdassemble.co.uk, where you can comment and find links to our social accounts. Plus, you can get in touch and ask us questions or comment on the show by email at contact@nerdassemble.co.uk. I'm still running that episode survey if you're interested. If you're a long-time listener, we're especially interested in hearing from you. But even, you know, newer listeners were also quite accommodating. But Paul, what's happening this episode?
Well, before I get into that, I'm just going to apologise in advance if you hear sniffling, because my nose is playing up a bit. I've had to take Puritan already. So also, if I end up snoring, then it's probably that and not because of what we're talking about.
If you end up snoring with the kind of setup that we've got going on with the mic, you will quite possibly deafen us.
How dare you?
No, I'm talking from experience here. This is a dangerous thing. Do not fall asleep.
Well, does his headset have that kind of mic that you can just move away?
No. It's
completely different setup, I'm afraid.
Anyway, yeah.
Getting back to what's happening. So BBC iPlayer is to extend availability of programs. Frostbite, mean-spirited April Fool's gag. When Game Jam reality web series goes wrong. And our feature is an interview with science fiction author Gareth Powell.
But first, this lovely bit of news regarding the BBC iPlayer, which is to extend the availability of programmes. For those of you, dear listeners, who haven't somehow realised, currently the BBC iPlayer will only keep episodes online for catch-up for 7 days after initial transmission.
Is that after initial or latest transmission?
Latest transmission. It does can get stuff like The Odd Bit of Doctor Who, I believe, if it was on BBC Three afterwards. But this is to be extended to 30 days from, I think, something like June, certainly a bit later this year.
Which is far better, because that's kind of in line with what Channel 4 does. And Channel 4, in terms of online services, has always been better than BBC, because, you know, Channel 4 have got, like, archived some of their older programmes on 4AD, as well as kind of allowing you to catch up over, like, 28 days or 30.
But it's, apart from the adverts, they're good.
Yes, the adverts do suck.
And the adverts that last time I tried skipping around in an episode because I was trying to find something, played again. And were unskippable.
I remember one time when I think the recording went wrong on our personal TV recorder.
Yeah.
And it kind of cut off the last about 5 minutes of a program. Mm. And this was kind of like an episode in the middle of a series as well. So, I basically ended up having to boot up 4OD and, kind of going through all of the adverts. You know, you can't just skip to the one point. You know, it just wouldn't allow you to do that. You kind of have to kind of, watch the adverts up until the episode actually starts, then try and skip to the, you know,
next relevant section. Break.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
Oh, it took absolutely ages for me to just find that one last 5 minute bit.
Advertising on-demand stuff is kind of annoying, but at the same time, it makes sense that Channel 4 have got it, considering their funding model.
But I'm fine with it, I just find it slightly...
I think they could perhaps make it a bit better. I'm not saying that the ads should be skippable, but it should be easy to navigate to different sections of a programme.
I think they should also expand the number of adverts, because it's, you know, when you're kind of watching, kind of a programme on 4OD, not all of the adverts that you see on TV will actually be played. So you kind of skip through the same three or four adverts throughout, you know, so like several times throughout the same programme.
Yeah.
And that's kind of wasteful, if nothing else.
Mind you, I think it might be partly just due to advertising sales. Anyway, BBC iPlayer, which doesn't have ads, at least at the moment, unless certain parties get their way, doesn't have ads, and it's going to extend to 30 days. There is one slight issue with the whole thing. It means, according to the Guardian's report on it, it means a further change will mean some programs are actually available for less time, with an end to the series stacking option that enables viewers to download all episodes of a series retrospectively.
Which is...
I never really actually knew about that feature, about, you know, kind of being able to skip back to all of the episodes. I didn't until this
got mentioned. But then, you see, I don't actually use iPlayer that much. I use 4OD far more than iPlayer. In terms of catch-up for television programmes. But that might be because Channel 4 is showing more programmes that I want to watch than BBC at the moment.
Very true.
I can't say that's true for me, but I would use iPlayer more if it wasn't for having Sky Plus, but then we're kind of trialling getting rid of Sky. So, from what I've used of iPlayer, it's pretty damn good. I quite like it.
I still remember the earlier buggier days for both players.
Oh yeah, the early days. Well, I was before any of this on-demand things. Does anyone remember UK Nova? Anyone heard of that?
No.
The name rings a bell. Deep.
It was a, let's just say it was a community-led UK television catch-up service using torrents. But this was before any of that was, you know, available. And, you know, that kind of, you know, there was a gentleman's agreement that as soon as anything like that, you know, anything like iPlayer showed up, to drop it. And that was very quickly done when iPlayer did come out.
Okay.
But yeah, it was very much a, you know, no one's doing this, we want it. And thankfully iPlayer came along, filled that gap, and it's been pretty good since. Apart from, you know, slightly rocky start, as most things do.
Yeah.
But in general, I'm all for this 30 days.
I think one thing, though, with the whole 30 days thing, which hasn't been mentioned so much, is that there's been a lot of talk lately about making people pay for the iPlayer service,
which I already do. Really? Thanks.
Yeah, it's like that. It's like, oh, it's either, I think, like adding an extra charge onto the license fee. It's like, well, look, just increase the license fee to accept the fact that, you know,
it's a license fee, not a subscription model. I mean, as soon as we start going, okay, well, you want to watch this channel or that channel, you're going to have to pay more. You're basically becoming Sky, aren't you?
Except with less programming.
Yeah.
Yeah, less programming, because Sky's programming, if it was actually having to rely on the things it made itself, and not just big series that it signed, you know, big deals with HBO and such, Jesus, what would Sky have? Other than sport, which I do not give a toss about.
There's the odd sort of homegrown drama or sort of genre series that they've got a finger in, but not much.
You want to know one of the nice, fun little things about quite a few of the Sky-owned productions? They use BBC filming facilities and studios.
Really?
If you look at the end of several of their own productions, it will say filmed at, you know, such and such, you know, BBC studio. Like various chat shows and things like that.
But, I mean, I think that concept's just ridiculous. Like, oh, well, you know, how many people don't actually watch much on stuff like BBC One?
Exactly.
I mean, BBC Two or whatnot.
I mean, good God, I don't watch much BBC One at all, especially not on Saturdays and weekends in general, but I don't begrudge them being there.
Exactly.
Because of the stuff I get out of it on BBC Four and BBC Two, it balances out very nicely, thanks very much.
I think part of the problem, though, is that due to the current government that we have in administration in this country, that the increase in talking about abolishing the licence fee has kind of gone up because they don't like the BBC because of the kind of model and service model it represents.
Yeah. Because they're arseholes.
It's
a general...
A lot of it's politically motivated. That I will say that there are problems with the BBC in the way it's structured and run, and that there are problems with wastage in various areas. But I wouldn't abolish the licence fee and dismantle the entire infrastructure just to deal with that. I would actually just, you know, deal with management issues.
Bear in mind that getting this foreign politics. Obviously, it was Thatcher that was, kind of separated, a load of stuff that was state run to, private companies. And how do you actually reverse that? You can't really.
Anyway.
So once you, do that to the BBC and to, other industries and whatnot, then it becomes, a post-BBC world.
In general, iPlayer is one of the awesome things that the BBC do. If you're in the UK, you get iPlayer.
I just hate the fact that it seems to be, most of the time, it seems to be the people that aren't necessarily using, the extended stuff. Like, say, for example, BBC Three. It's the people that are not using that kind of complain that they're having to pay for it. And it's like, it's one big block. Money's going to the BBC.
Still got Radio 4 and 3. Shut up.
Yeah, how many things do the rest of us, think that are crap that you carry on watching, and, our money's going towards your show, so,
Yeah, it all kind of balances out. There's no, apart from when they're showing Doctor Who, that's about the only time I'd go near, TV on a Saturday. Because I have no interest in anything else. But on on our Skybox, most of the things that we record, you see BBC, 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 Sky Atlantic, Fox, BBC. You see far more BBC than anything else on that list. And I think that is an example of, the kind of spread, the general spread that they do. And I keep hearing people saying, I don't even watch iPlayer. I don't even watch any of that. And it's just, what the hell are you watching then?
I'm going to move us on now to an April Fool's gag that perhaps backfired a bit for somebody at Frostbite.
Oh.
With background to the tweet itself, the tweet itself has been deleted and the parent company, EA, has issued an apology.
So basically there was a series of tweets on April Fool's Day that, April, it was obvious that it was an April Fool's. That was obvious. It was the...
Yeah, it wasn't, it's taking people in. It's like, no, it was fairly damn obvious that it was April Fool's.
It was just the fact that it seemed really mean-spirited considering the history of the situation involving the Frostbite game engine and the Nintendo Wii U.
I have a slightly different view on this than...
Than me.
All I'm betting, yeah.
I mean, I don't mind, kind of a little bit of jokiness, between companies and whatnot. And I think, to a certain extent, you have to kind of think about the audience for what the thingy was. I think, what did the tweet say? That the Frostbite engine had now been optimised for the Wii U hardware, allowing... What?
And it had listed games like Zelda and stuff. Basically.
Yeah, it said that it had been optimized for Zelda and Super Mario. A previous tweet said that they were also showing off the Battlefield 4 PEX FX engine and effect. Obviously, taking the piss of the Tress FX.
Okay.
In things like Tomb Raider, where it was like, oh, if you've got an AMD card, you can have hair simulated slightly differently using physics. And it's only broken maybe 20% of the time, making it look like it's attacking her face. So they'd taken the piss out of TressFX, and then they went on and said, yeah, we've optimized for, our Frostbite engine for Zelda. And... Hmm. Super Mario for the, the Wii U. And it was just, who's going to be following the Frostbite? This was the Frostbite engine official account.
Yeah.
And it actually had reasonably few followers, even considering it was an official Twitter account for the Frostbite engine, for God's sake.
And I think to a certain extent, it's kind of where it comes from, because obviously, even if Frostbite was optimized for the Wii U, why bring Mario and Zelda into it? Obviously,
it's more you want to get better because field those on are the
Nintendo.
Yeah, but I mean, from an outside perspective, you're basically just saying that that's all Nintendo has in a way. It's probably reading too much into it.
I think the bitterness over the whole thing is the fact that EA's third-party type support for the Wii U is, you know, like non-existent these days.
Well, it's not just that, but I think to a certain extent, some people in the game industry are actually becoming a little bit unprofessional with how they do stuff. Because, I mean, businesses, you know, you're obviously meant to be keeping, you know, like a fair open partnership to a certain extent. Even with businesses that you have nothing to do with at the moment, you're not kind of antagonistic.
Mm.
But that doesn't seem to be the case with some of the, you know, people in the games.
The thing is, though, is that we're also dealing with different corporate cultures because the basis of both of these companies is in America. And actually, there is a slightly more visible competitive edge between companies in America in comparison to over here, where it's more kind of like discreet, in a metaphorical, non-literal way, you know, discreet kind of like 10 paces at dawn situation between businesses over here, and then nobody ever hears about it until just kind of like, and this company's been absorbed into this one, and nobody hears about it again.
Hmm.
It was just a bit of an odd thing to do. If they'd spread it out a bit more, just to, you know, make it more, I mean, the thing with, the, you know, PEX effects, which is like, well, that's obviously a ridiculous thing. And then they went on to, you know, take the piss with saying, oh, yeah, we've optimized all this for, you know, Zelda franchises. If they'd also said something like, you know, Battlefield 5 coming exclusively to, you know, iOS, that would have been, you know, a far more obvious thing. You know, spread it out a little bit more. You know, in a way, they did two or three tweets, you know, on the Wii U and, It's just, don't be cruel. We know it's not, you know, the hardware isn't, you know, powerful enough for the new generation of, you know, the engines where they're doing, you know, on the, like, 8-core next-gen consoles. The Wii U isn't that hardware. So, you know, we already know you're not doing it, but don't. Be polite. Play nice.
If I was going to assess this as a quality of April Fool's gag, I would say it was one of the worst ones from last week, just purely due to the fact that if it's deemed at such a level that EA's chief operating officer, Peter Moore, has to issue an apology afterwards for the tweets, and the tweets have been... That's obviously an April Fool's gag that wasn't worthy of being an April Fool's gag.
I mean, take, for example, the contrast with the guy at... Smash Bros was doing, basically, was it Nesticle? Well, no, it's not Nesticle. You know, basically,
there was an old emulator called that, by the way.
Yeah, I do remember that. But there was like a character, you know, kind of, oh yes, we've got this character and isn't it? And it's I think it's meant Nestor. Yeah, I think it's Nestor actually. And I think he had something to do with like old Nintendo comics or something.
Right.
I'm not 100% sure, but, you know, they basically don't... Obviously, you know, he must have spent time on it because he's kind of built this character model. Admittedly, it didn't exactly look like it was, you know, sort of like something suitable for the Wii U, but by the same token, you know, he actually went into the, you know, and had him, like, in the screenshots and everything. And yep. I thought that was, you know, quite a good one. And, you know, I remember the... quite a few years ago now, probably about 2007 or so, IGN actually had an April Fool's, which was basically Legend of Zelda the movie.
Yeah.
You know, so I think April Fool's has more become about basically, wouldn't it be cool if? Type thing.
It's also, unfortunately,
or things that were so ridiculous as well. Because, yeah. I'm just remembering one of the newspapers... had it in its science section that scientists have discovered an extra colour in a rainbow.
Oh, yeah.
But, I mean...
And I thought, you know, how many people have discovered that? It's like, come on, you know, slow down, think about it.
I don't mind the media doing April Fools, but there's also an issue when you're obviously a company selling like to a specific product for a specific market and you're making it fools, because it's really, it's just a bit of marketing rather than joining in. That's it's like coming out,
think about it a little bit.
So
that's all we ask.
I like the kind of fun ones. You know, fun April Fools.
It was a fairly poor year for April Fools.
It was actually, yeah.
Has to be said.
I was kind of people praising the Domino's pizza box one was. I was just kind of like, really?
Oh, the edible one.
To be fair, I've eaten like containers for chips in Germany that were edible. You know.
Yeah.
Like, take away chips, and like the thing they were in was just like this kind of like thing you could eat rather than having to just chuck it.
Sort of like rice cardboard or something.
Yeah, so it's just kind of like, well, you know, it is actually a thing. You couldn't actually probably do that with Domino's pizza due to the sheer amount of grease, to be fair. It'd just probably destroy the container.
And the container would probably be nicer.
That's also that.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm going to move us on now to our final bit of games news for the week, or news, or event, or somebody was making a reality web series called Game Jam. That's all capitals with an underscore between the two words.
Because it's all, oh look, we're doing it computery. Ooh.
And it was being filmed in the US. And it didn't appear to have any mainstream like production companies behind it. However, Mountain Dew were a sponsor.
Which it always goes well with game journalism and production. Always.
Mountain Dew's probably one of the worst drinks that somebody doing a sedentary activity should be drinking.
Have all this sugar. You need that energy for sitting on your ass and not speaking as someone who likes sitting on his ass.
I think it's actually kind of weird how Mountain Dew and Doritos are kind of seen as kind of almost like gaming consumables, like in America. But I don't think it's quite gotten over here, has it?
No. They're trying, because they give out little cups at like places like the Eurogamer Expo. And they've got, you know, branding. I think they're seen as gaming food brands, because they were amongst the first to actually bother. But, so they're almost by default.
So there's two sides to this Game Jam story, though. Yeah, so on the one hand, we have the what ended up being the excessive promotion of Mountain Dew on camera and by the poor developers that were trying to do the Game Jam. Like, it got to a stage where even during breaks, when there was no filming happening, apparently, that poor individuals that were competing or taking part, essentially, if they wanted to swig a bottle of water, no, their director would swipe that away from them, make them have Mountain Dew.
Wow, really?
Insane. Yeah.
And if any game developers come from this and get, like, diabetes or anything.
Well, you know, it could be grand. It's just insane. It's just kind of like, okay.
It's like, you know, corporate sponsorship, okay, fine. But not to that extent. It's a bit like, you know, that bit in Wayne's World.
Oh, yeah.
Where they're doing the product placement bit. It sounds a bit like that.
Really fake.
You know, fine, you know, put the drinks there and then people can drink them. But
people were getting quite ill behind the scenes, really, due to the excessive amounts of...
I'm not surprised. You know, you have one, and you know, well, that's fine.
Just about.
Yeah, have two, and you're probably going to be puking sugar.
Or peeing it, depending.
And it's having fluorescent pee.
It's going to be painful either way, I think.
Vomiting rainbows.
So if that was so, and it was the director apparently that was kind of leading on, bigging up this excessive consumption of an energy drink. Then later on, before the first episode got a chance to finish recording. This is quoting the Mary Sue. The final straw came when the four teams, only two of which had a single female member, were asked, do you think you're at an advantage because you have a pretty girl on your team? And another question was asked: do you think the teams with women on there are on them are at a disadvantage? And this was the director apparently asking these questions. And I think you can imagine that at this point, the game jam actually crumbled pretty quickly.
Yeah, very justifiably, because I wouldn't put up with shite like that. It's 2014, for fuck's sake.
I mean, it's not just that, but I mean, it's the kind of tactics. I mean, we've heard when we had Alex Boyle on the show about, you know, what they try to kind of manipulate out of the situation.
This is in the name reality
you
TV.
You can either have reality or you can have entertainment. Don't kind of try and have reality, but stick entertainment into it.
And then it's questionable entertainment, because it's only entertainment to a small-minded group of individuals who think this kind of thing's fucking funny.
I mean,
and it's not.
Seriously, what the hell? I mean, asking it, what the hell, pretty girl on your team or having a woman on your team a disadvantage? Why do you think they're there in the first place? They're indie developers.
They know their stuff. They would have been picked to be in it if they didn't.
It's a bit like you see those, you know, like a comedy sketch show, and you have someone who's an incredibly old sexist, and you know they're about to go in for an operation, and they find their doctor's a woman. You know, it's that kind of situation. Except, I'm betting that this person wasn't that old, probably younger than me. And it's, you know, they're supposed to be in the, you know, sort of gaming sphere, whether they're a developer or not. So they're in that, you know, that kind of arena. And actually thinking that, you know, actually asking that, it boggles my mind. What kind of justification is there?
Well, I think, considering this is like the, there's been a lot of instances in the past year where people have been questioning the methods used to create reality TV. I do hope that perhaps the general public begins to get wind of it a bit more and begins to realise maybe we shouldn't be supporting this crap. Or certainly not the way it's made, because it's not actually very ethical to be stir up this kind of crap for the sake of entertainment.
I would love to think so, but every time I think, oh, come on, you know, this has blown the top off such and such, the general public will like these now, I'm proven wrong.
To be honest, I think part of the problem is, though, is that they've kind of got this niche geek kind of subject, and they're trying to widen it out to the general public. If they were actually, went and actually filmed it as it was,
and then just put it together afterwards.
Exactly. Almost more like a documentary rather than reality TV. I think that will work out far better.
The thing is that because obviously this was going straight to web, at least initially, as a series, one has to then question that perhaps there wasn't a more general audience sort of like in mind. If they were hoping to produce it for web and have a certain degree of viewer on it who tends to be the ones that leave the comments on things by people like Kez and McDonald that you don't want to read.
Oh, Jesus.
You know, that kind of audience was actually their target audience, in which case the questions were entirely appropriate, and unfortunately the developers that had been sort of like roped into making this series didn't know what they were getting in for.
Well, God. I'm just thinking comments, video comments, YouTube comments, forum comments, and article comments where I was just an incredible facepalm.
Yeah, but I'm just saying,
I've almost got X-ray vision through my hand.
I'm just saying
out of necessity, just from constant facepalm.
I'm just saying though that unfortunately there is perhaps an audience for that kind of questioning happening in a reality TV show, idea of actually making something to appeal to them pisses me off.
We've got our episode with the what was the series called?
Geeks, wasn't it?
I was thinking Geeks, but yeah. Where this is the kind of manipulation that was going on behind the scenes, you know, with the not telling people this and telling people that, but not showing that part of it. And there's Charlie Brooker has done a rather nice exposure. Well, not really an expose, but sort of a guide of the editing techniques that take place on these reality shows. When things like Big Brother, where they can't directly influence the members, where they'll just say these are the kinds of techniques that they use. Camera angles, cutting, editing. This is how they put them together to make a narrative, and that's how they do all these. So you've got all these, and as you say, with the audience, in the US, what would it be, Spike TV?
Potentially, if it's not its own thing on the web that they were trying to do standalone.
Yeah, I can only think, seeing as Spike TV do the Game Awards in the US, that they were thinking, yeah, these are probably who we're aiming at, the sort of, Xbox bros, for want of a better term. That kind of audience. And why would... I just don't know. Because surely that audience wouldn't be that interested in indie gamers in the first place. So what was it just, this is what gamers are like, so we'll get these people involved or treat them like this? I mean, there's a bit here. Because I've been looking at it on Eurogamer as well, because they covered it this week. Davey was forced to take off his nail polish because he couldn't hold the can with it on, wrote freelance journalist and Polaris contributor Jared Rosen in his harrowing expose in the Fiasco and the Indie Static. Zoe, this will be Zoe Quinn, had to take off the buttons she usually wears on her jacket, but shouted down a PA who tried to make her cover her tattoos. The Arcane Kids were screamed at for not holding bottles right, while the entire group was lectured how to properly smell like you're enjoying the product. A product that everyone was enjoying less and less. I mean, what the hell? They've got people in with a certain, approach, and then they're trying to completely change their approach to how they're working and, just who they are. It's not an advert. You're not filming an advert for Mountain Dew. You're supposed to be doing a reality thing with them as a sponsor.
It certainly makes me think that documentary television and filmmaking is a far better medium when you're like indie game, the movie and stuff.
Yeah.
So it's like, don't watch this, just go rewatch Indie Game the Movie. That's probably a much better thing to be doing. But I'm going to move us on now, unfortunately, or fortunately perhaps, to what we've been up to this week. So somebody's been playing Assassin's Creed 4.
Hello. More.
Has it been you, Retroid?
I have been, me. Yes. I have been Jolly Rogering around the Caribbean.
Ooh.
That, no, maybe that's DLC.
Is there actually any opportunities to make people walk the plank in that game? Because I've been wondering that.
There has been no plank walking.
That sucks.
However, more or less everything else about the game does not suck.
Okay.
I've been really enjoying it. You have the assassins bits, which are the small settlements and the towns that you come across while you're sailing around. And the rest of the time, you've got an excellent naval combat and simulator with just sailing around on the open seas, which looks gorgeous. At least on PC, I presume it does on the consoles as well. And you can collect sea shanties and have the crew sing them while you're just sailing around through all sorts of kinds of weather and just sunrise, sunset, beautiful open ocean with whales breaking the surface beside you, which you can hunt, but I don't because I'm soft get. And it's really relaxing. It's open world as it should be, and I've really been enjoying it. As I say, it looks nice as well, and I have been humming sea shanties. That's an inescapable thing. That's a symptom.
Is it better than 3, considering that yes. You literally just completed 3 before starting this?
Yeah, I forced my way through 3, which 3 isn't a bad game, it's just... It could have been done far better. There's far more to do in Black Flag than there is in Assassin's Creed 3. You can spend hours pretty much on the ocean if you want, and I have been. So it's been a wonderful bit of escapism.
What sort of decade is it meant to be taking place in, or year?
Early 1800s.
So is before...
it's before Assassin's Creed 3.
And it would be before slavery is abolished as well. Wait, so is it before Assassin's Creed 3? Because I thought Assassin's Creed 3, if that's...
The you're playing Edward Kenway in Black Flag, who is the father of Haytham Kenway.
Okay.
In Assassin's Creed 3, and he in turn is the father of Connor, who is the assassin in Assassin's Creed 3.
Okay.
So you've got, you know, a reasonable gap in time there, and it's far more. Has anyone played Sid Meier's Pirates?
No. I haven't played that many. I've played a couple of Sid Meier's games, but that's not one of them.
I'm very disappointed in both of you. I played the Commodore 64 original, which I would let you off not playing because I am an old bastard. But he did an Xbox and PC and also PSP sort of reimagining, where it was brought far more up to date. And that is also a pretty damn good version. So if either of you see that, it's also backwards compatible with 360. So if either of you see that, you know, around, because it's probably like a pound or two or something in, you know, whichever shops actually keep these pre-owned, it's well worth picking up. And I just find it really... I can both simultaneously understand, because pirates are not the coolest thing. It's only with, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean that, you know, pirates aren't a lol. Why would you be playing a pirate game? Sid Meier's Pirates is just about one of the only pirate games, not counting, obviously, Guybrush Threepwood in that, because they're adventures. But there's been a shocking lack of piratey games, and this is really, you know, scratching my Sid Meier's Pirate's itch. So I've been really enjoying that.
You have a pirate itch.
Yes, it's probably scurvy. So I should be eating oranges, but unfortunately, oranges give me migraines. So I would make a really shit pirate. But as well as Assassin's Creed 4, I've also been playing Hotline Miami, which I got as part of PlayStation Plus. So I've been playing that on PSP, Vita, which in a lot of ways to me, it feels more like a natural home, you know, for the game. And I've come to the conclusion that I kind of like it, but it's a bit broken and flawed. And I don't accept that what I perceive as the flaws in the, you know, the game design are game design. Because I've seen people describe it as, oh, you'll be restarting levels more often than you'll be whacking people with baseball bats or shooting them. And they seem to think that's great. I don't so much. Have either of you played it?
I've kind of got put off trying to go near it after Oh No Video Games covered it last year. It's kind of staying away.
Yeah, I saw it described as kind of a more localized GTA, which I can only conclude that the person who was in the describing it as that is the kind of person who has only ever played GTA.
Or didn't play the earlier GTA games.
Yeah, because maybe it's more of a link to the original, you know, GTA games, because it's top down. But yeah, there's not much there, and the gist of it is you're given a contract, you've got to go to these buildings and kill everyone. Now, they have field of vision, which you can't see, but they're either facing you or not. They've either got melee weapons or they've got firearms. There are dogs and, you know, things like that. If you make a noise, they will react to it, that kind of thing. I came to the conclusion yesterday that when I was restarting a stage, and yeah, people can say, this is because you're crap, which, okay, fine, I'll put my hands up to this. I was restarting this level for the 20th time. When I'm redoing this stage, and I've killed all but one person, and they almost clairvoyantly see me and shoot me through a window from across the level, and I'm dead, and that's it, and I have to press X, and I have to restart and play, you know, that from the very beginning. I'm thinking, yeah, it's all fine making a game that's hard and, you know, has all these rules with the, you know, the enemy AI and whether they can see you or not. It's all very well doing it like that, but when it's just insta death, I'll take so many restarts as the price, but when it starts racking up that much.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a certain amount that you can kind of put down to your lack of skill level, and then there's like, no, the computer's cheating. He shouldn't be able to do that kind of thing.
Yeah, it was just getting a little bit silly, and I was enjoying the first few levels, but when it got to the, you know, about the 20th restarting level, it's just, yeah, I think I'll put this down again.
I mean, especially if you're dying at the exact same place every time as well.
Yeah. Which I pretty much was. I mean, there are missions I've been playing through on Black Flag where, and I'm sure, you know, everyone's had this experience, where you just slightly screw up and you keep having to restart. And then when you finally get past that bit, you've been maybe about 10 seconds away from the checkpoint.
Yeah.
Or the end of the section. And that's fine. It's a bit annoying, but, you know, that's just kind of how things are sometimes.
Yeah.
But it's like Hotline Miami is that as a game mechanic.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, it's let's keep trying to trip you up and see you, you know, if you can get through this, you know, this the way or the other. And it's like, yeah, okay, fine. I mean, I can see how other people will enjoy it, but not me.
I mean, is there kind of anything that you do differently, you know, when you do finally succeed, or is it just a little bit of luck?
I think it's quite a bit of luck with it. I mean, yeah,
that strikes me as quite bad game design, to be honest. I mean, it's one thing if somebody's stuck on a certain area, they can't progress, and then all of a sudden, yes, they've learned something or figured out how to do something or pressed whatever. But if it's like, no, I've done the same thing that I've done 50 times before, only this time,
yeah,
I got a bit lucky. No.
I mean, on this particular level, you start off in the car outside. You can walk right in, and to the left, round a corner, there's a guard with a baseball bat. And I was walking up behind him, and I was managing to whack him, eight times out of 10, using the exact same timing, just going, you know, straight up, whack. And then other times it just, you know, whack me first. And other times, I'd get through him, I'd go into another room, and it would seem like the characters would just not really respond to me. And other times it would be, you know, as soon as the door went, it would be, there you go, shotgun in the face. And it's I'm not quite seeing refined game mechanics on this.
Hmm. Well, Paul, what have you been,
Me? Yeah, well, apart from Final Fantasy X, I don't want to talk about that because I talked about that last week and I've still been going through it and, you know, doing all the extra stuff to Uber myself, as it were.
Cool.
Because who doesn't want to Uber themselves?
I'm Ubering myself, as I say.
Uber! Sorry. Sorry, yeah, I've been watching Brooklyn Nine-Nine. It's been on 4OD for...
Well, past Channel 4.
6-7 weeks, something like that.
Channel 4. You said 4OD, because we were talking about 4OD.
Ah, yeah, obviously. Yeah, sorry,
it's been screening on E4 on Thursday evenings.
Yeah.
The Channel 4 family of channels and media outlets.
I mean, before this, I'd never really heard of Andy Samberg. And to be honest, you know, when they advertised it, it was like, oh, yes, and it's Andy Samberg on it. And it was like, I don't know who that is, but the actual footage that they show was, you know, really what inspired me to watch it. And it actually is very funny. I think the one thing that I like about it is that it's far more to do with the characters in the police station and, you know, the cases that they get, it kind of like, you know, because we've had so many TV shows where it's been like, oh yes, and the guys are on this case and the case is really important and the case is the episode, and it's like,
yeah,
it doesn't really work like that.
Sending up the whole crime procedural drama obsession that has somehow not left mainstream telly.
I mean, to a certain extent, I would probably say that it's the Scrubs of the police world. Only, I think Andy Samberg, he's very different to Zach Braff. Well, in many terms, he's kind of very similar, but yeah, I think Andy Samberg does actually work quite well alone-ish, as it were.
Does this mean we're not going to get the police equivalent of Guy Love?
Well, not as it currently stands, no.
Okay.
I've actually been finding it funnier than the first two Police Academy films. So.
That's fair enough.
But even with the bloke who does the voices, that sound like things.
Yeah, even regardless of that.
Blimey.
Yeah.
Wait, that's a high bar.
The guy that... Do you mean the Channel 4 guy that does...
No, as in, you know, Police Academy, Moat Mouth.
Oh, yes. Oh, right, okay.
Yeah.
And was it Bobcat Goldthwait?
Sorry?
Bobcat Goldthwait later on as well.
Hmm.
I'm showing my age here.
But yeah, anyway, no.
just let Uncle Paul waffle about shite from the 80s in the corner. It keeps him happy.
Fair enough. But, anyway.
Sorry, did I put you off?
Well, no, it was actually Emily mouthing something towards me. I'm not quite sure what it was. Did you just want to say what you...
Puppies.
Oh, yes, last episode had some puppies. Emily's a bit gaga for puppies. You can't have one at the moment, but when we do finally manage to be able to be in a position to have one, then I'll imagine she'll get probably 10 of them.
Yeah.
And regret it.
She's me, instantly. But with cats.
Yeah. But there were puppies in last week's episode, and they were the police captain's puppies.
Yeah.
And he was trying to give them away to people, and he had some reasonably high standards, and they were most adorable things imaginable on television that night, and it was incredibly funny as well. Just
were you volunteering to the television?
Yes.
I mean, I think one of the things that strikes me about the series is that all of the characters have their own kind of quirks, and they're not quite right, but they're still actually quite lovable.
It's sounding a little bit like, have either of you watched Community?
That's something that we do want to watch. I'm not sure what... Is it on Netflix?
No, it's not.
You've tried?
Yeah.
Oh, man. I'll have to go buy the DVDs or something then. But yeah, I've heard very, very, very good things about Community, and I really am looking forward to watching it when we do finally manage to, you know,
find a legitimate means of actually watching it.
Yeah.
Like, finally, just buy the DVD.
It's like once again, one of those, come on, give us a nice legal way to watch all these things on demand or something, because that's what we want. We are happy with it.
But I mean, that's the thing, Community, as far as I'm aware, it hasn't been shown on terrestrial TV in the UK. So
I don't think it has, no.
The amount of American series that kind of end up going straight to DVD.
Or Sky.
Or Sky to a certain extent. But
a lot of it's been going to Sky.
Yeah, but I mean, even then, you know, it's like it ends up on DVD, and that's what people kind of... That's the only way that people watch it that don't actually subscribe to Sky.
But yeah, which is kind of like why I quite support Netflix.
Can I talk about Sorcerer?
No.
Oh. Yes. Sorcerer is a film that Paul and I saw at the weekend on Saturday at another Mark Mode-led film screening at our local cinema. And perhaps it was the highly personalised message that was recorded by the film's director, William Friedkin, aka the dude that, you know, brought us The Exorcist and The French Connection, that perhaps highly biased me towards the film, or it was the fact that it was actually a really bloody good film. But basically, Sorcerer isn't what you think it is, considering that it's from the guy that brought you The Exorcist. It has nothing to do with supernatural stuff, but a couple of bits of imagery. It's about four despicable men who end up in the Dominican Republic in perhaps one of the worst bits of jungle imaginable, who have to do one of the worst jobs imaginable, and basically end up on this slow descent to hell. And it's an adaptation of the... Was it Wages?
The Wages of Fear.
The Wages of Fear.
Can I just inquire? It's like, what do you think is the worst job imaginable?
Silence.
That isn't a rhetorical question.
I was going to... Yeah, having watched...
David Cameron's Bodyguard.
having re-watched Season 2 X-Files episode The Host yesterday...
Oh, hang on, I remember. Master of the Stool.
What?
You know what that is then, don't you, Emily?
What?
No? Master of the Stool. That's possibly the worst job in the world. I might have got the title wrong, but it was effectively having the honour of looking after the king's potty.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, Master of the Stool.
I think I'll just tell you what.
No, there you go.
So yeah, basically they're kind of taking unstable explosives across the country.
Across over 200 miles of hostile rainforest, swamp, bit of desert, but mostly swamp. And oh my god, the film's never had a proper release outside of the US. You see, this was an unlucky film. So Friedkin made it. It was the studio gave him permission to make this thing, and he was kind of like, it was during the, was it auteur phase, the studios went through, where they were like, directors can do no wrong, throw money at them, leave them to it. And this is one of the last films that which got to do this. I filmed it 4 years to make. He insisted on filming it in the Dominican Republic, apart from one bit where they had a bridge, a hydraulic bridge, which they started building over a river in the Dominican Republic, and then they had to move it to Mexico because the river in the Dominican Republic kind of disappeared.
It dried up.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah. And then it kind of did the same in Mexico, so they had to just bring the river to it eventually. But anyway, Friedkin made this film, and it took 4 years to make. It took $20 million in 70s money, which is a lot of money to make, and it released the week after the first Star Wars movie.
Yeah, that was good timing.
Yeah, so I'm sure you can imagine how well it did. It didn't do very well. It freaking bombed. It was one of the worst films in Friedkin's career in terms of it not actually being a success. And it's not actually a bad film. This is the annoying thing. It's technically a very competent and well-made film, but due to poor titling, is why you should have a title that isn't too kind of obtuse, nondescript. It's why titles should perhaps at least partially reflect what the friggin' thing's about.
If it had the title of the book it was based on.
Yeah, that was the thing. If it had, and obviously there'd been a film adaptation of the book anyway, it would have been fine, but it didn't. You know, they just called it Sorcerer because of the fact that they just kind of wanted to reference just a, kind of like a couple of things from the past, and they did, but yeah. And it had, Roy Scheider, the guy that was Sheriff in Jaws in one of the lead roles, and yeah, he was really good in it, but it wasn't enough to sell the film. And when they tried releasing internationally, they thought the reason it didn't do well originally was because of its slow opening. So they cut the first half hour, thus bringing forth internationally a film that made no sense. Because you had no idea why these men were where they were. They were just there.
What the hell is the point of that?
Yeah. And it hasn't, as I've said, it hasn't had a proper release since, either cinematically or on home sort of, you know, systems. Like, there's been some bad pan and scan stuff and whatever. And what we watched at the cinema was a remastered version.
Yeah, 4K.
4K of the film that had been done originally for the Venice Film Festival. And I think it was only perhaps the second or third outing for this particular remastering of the film. And it's looking like it might actually get a Blu-ray release in the US by the end of this month. But I haven't seen anything that looks like it's getting a proper re-release over here. We'll just have to see. I'm hoping to write a full review, retrospective of this thing for Hex, actually.
Now,
but yeah.
Is this available on any of the on-demand services?
Or...
Yeah. Why? This is the kind of thing where it should be perfect for it.
It
should just be able to, you know, stumble across it. You know, film other films starring that bloke from Jaws.
It's a lost gem, and basically, if the more people talk about it, the more likely that home releases will become widely available in at a decent quality. Pretty much is what it's looking like. So yeah. If you have them, if you have a slightly independent cinema near you, maybe just say to them, go get it. Go grab that Venice copy. That little cinema down in Cornwall did. We can too.
Yeah, let's face it, if Cornwall can get something like that, then...
Yeah. But anyway.
Yeah, we're in a worse situation than you are by the sounds of it, because we don't get anything like that.
Mind you, it probably helps that Mark May seems to like coming on holiday down here.
Well, it's not just that. It's also to do with the fact that because our cinema actually has some good projectionists.
Oh, no, not just good projectionists. Our local cinema has award-winning projectionists. Thank you very much.
So, thank you very much, personally insulting you.
Project it into a shed or something around the back of the cinema, that kind of thing. Upside down, backwards.
No. Oh, was it? There was a little snide comment about was it Cineworld with the Raid 2 the past couple of weeks?
Oh, yeah.
Cineworld or whatever, and the whole, because they didn't have any projectionists at a huge multiplex or something, and all the screenings of the Raid 2 went completely horribly wrong because you couldn't actually see the film properly on the screen, and so all the top subtitles were cut off.
Mm.
Hooray!
Like, you see, kind of zoomed in too much and kind of cut off so much of the picture.
So it's good, but you know what? I'm going to move us on now because we've got a fantastic interview with science fiction author Gareth Powell for you to listen to now, and just say that he refers to in this interview a particular article, and you will be able to find a link to this article in our show notes if you want to actually go see what he was sort of talking about, that he does a very good take on it. So here's our interview with Gareth Powell. All right, well, I've managed to snag a quick interview with science fiction or SF or speculative fiction writer. I'll ask about that in a bit. Writer Gareth Powell, who's based in the UK.
Hello.
I wanted to start by asking what originally inspired the Interzone short story that Ak Macaque was kind of born from.
Oh, right. That's going back a ways now.
I know.
It was, God, I can't believe it was 7 years ago that appeared in Interzone. First of all, I started it. I was writing a sort of artificial intelligence story where it's a sort of a cartoon character becomes sentient and takes his World War One, which is World War One in the short story, battles into the real world, and he starts taking down German airliners and blowing up the German stock exchange and things because he thinks he's still fighting World War One when it's actually much later, and he's not realizing the consequences of what he's doing online. And you know, as I sort of made up the character there, it was mainly this sort of love story between the woman who invents this cartoon character and her loser boyfriend, told from the loser boyfriend's point of view. And I'd made up this cartoon character just to, because I needed one for the story. And I'd had the phrase Akak Macaque floating around in my head and scribbled it down in my notebook, but I didn't really know what it was. It was just two words that seemed to bang up against each other quite nicely. So when I decided to use that as the name for the cartoon character, I realised I had to make him a fighter pilot monkey, because obviously Akak is a type of anti-aircraft fire used in the war, and a macaque is a monkey. So I thought, fighter pilot monkey, can't go wrong with that. And that's where he came from. And I thought, after the short story, I put him aside, and you know, he only appeared in a handful of paragraphs in the short story, but he seemed to strike a bit of a chord with the readers and with me, and I found I still had a lot to say about him, and he's now expanded to fill his own trilogy of novels. So yeah, he's certainly come a long way.
That is quite a transformation, I have to admit, having read several of the novels now. Okay, well then, science fiction or speculative fiction?
Personally, science fiction. I think, A, because everybody knows what it means. I think outside of the sort of genre community, I don't think a lot of sort of casual readers really get what speculative fiction means. I've got nothing against the term, I just think it can be a little confusing. When people come and pick up one of my books, it says, so I identify myself as a science fiction writer, so they've got a pretty good idea what they're going to get. They're going to get spaceships, you know, they're going to get, well, they might not suspect they're going to get monkeys, but they, you know, whereas they're not going to get 10,000 orcs sweeping down across a plain to fight an army of dwarves, because, you know, that's fantasy, and I've not really ventured into that yet. So I call myself a science fiction writer so that people have a very clear kind of understanding of the sort of territory I'm scoping out.
Is it possible for you to sort of tell us a bit about your next novel?
All right, well, I've recently finished my fourth novel for Solaris Books, which is the third in the Macaque trilogy, and it's called Macaque Attack, and it's due out from Solaris in January next year. So, you know, it's quite a long lead time coming up to it, but that means there will have been a monkey book out every January for 3 years, and this will be the third one. So yeah, it's been a bit of a kind of emotional experience writing it, because I've never written a trilogy before of novels, and I've never spent that much time with the same characters. So I've kind of taken them on quite a journey from the first book through the second book, and then now into the third. They've kind of grown and they've changed, and I've grown and changed, and it's been, you know, over the last 4 years I've been writing these three books. So that's quite a long time to spend in the head of the same group of characters. So in a way, I'm quite sorry to be wrapping up their story and sort of seeing them off, at least for the time being. But at the same time, I'm really excited to get on and write something different, because 4 years is a long time to spend writing in the same world. And I'm now sort of halfway through another book, which is more of a sort of traditional science fiction novel, in that it features spaceships and alien ruins and a small town in Herefordshire. And yeah, and so I'm really excited to be getting on with that. Okay. But yeah, the three monkey books are brilliant, and I just really hope the last one wraps everything up to the satisfaction of the readers.
What challenges do you face to make your books as original as possible in sort of the genre? Other than having monkeys that talk.
Other than having talking monkeys. Ooh, I don't know, because I just kind of write the stories that come to me. There are ideas, and I think if you read widely in your sort of chosen genre, you get a sense of the stuff that's been done to death and the stuff that's been done so many times that it would just, you know, there's nothing new to say about it. But that having been said, you know, there's the old saying that there are no new ideas under the sun, and every story is just a retelling of, you know, one of the archetypal stories with a few details changed. So most of the time, if I've got a story, they kind of come to me and they kind of evolve, and I kind of write them and they evolve as they're writing, and I just chuck in everything I think is too cool not to chuck in. And But if I kind of come across another book and think, oh, it's too similar, then yeah, obviously I'm going to change things and going to try and change it around. But I've never felt under pressure to try and be extra original, because I just kind of try and write the books I want to read, and or rather the books that, you know, me 20 years ago would have wanted to read, if you see what I mean.
Yeah. Who would you name as perhaps your main science fiction influences, other writers that influence you?
Well, I grew up, I was very lucky as I was growing up that our local library had quite a well-stocked science fiction section. Well, I'd been very into Star Wars and Star Trek when I was at sort of 5 or 6 years old, and I discovered this book with all spaceships and things on the front, and there was a whole shelf of them, and they all had astronauts and spaceships, and it was brilliant. I think I started off with Brian Earnshaw's Dragonfall 5 books, which are sort of aimed at junior school level readers, and then sort of branched out through, there was another series I can't remember, and this is thinking back like 35 years of a group of international astronauts. I think there was an American, a British, maybe an Australian and a Russian, and they sort of go off. They had an adventure on the moon, and they had an adventure on Mercury, and they flew to Jupiter or something. And there was that series, and I sort of discovered Arthur C. Clarke when I was about 11 when I first read one of his short story collections, and it had the 9 billion names of God in it. If you're familiar with that one, with its very famous closing line. And it had The Sentinel, which was the basis for the 2001 A Space Odyssey, and all these just stories that just blew my brain apart, because they were just nothing like the sort of the adventure stories I'd read before, or sort of Star Wars, where the point of it was to rescue a princess, blow stuff up, and get out of there. This was more that this was books. This was The 9 billion Names of God. It was about a computer who'd been built to come up with the 9 billion names of God, with the idea that once it's collated them all, the universe will end, and then they switch it on. And that's just when you're 11, these kind of stories just blow your mind. There was another one about an art thief who's approached by a woman from the future who's got a magic device that can freeze time, and so he can go in and loot to the British Museum for her. And then he discovers that she's come from the future to rescue these art treasures, because this super bomb that's being tested today is going to wipe out civilization. The twist is the bomb has already exploded, but because they've got this device that can stop time, this art thief is left knowing he can live out the remainder of his life by himself in a world of frozen people, or turn the device off and be wiped out moments later. So it's just, you know, these weren't the kind of stories we were seeing on Star Trek. So that really kind of fired my interest, and I went from there. I went through Larry Niven, Robert Heinlein, all the usual suspects. I knew I wanted to be a sci-fi writer, but I couldn't seem to write anything in that vein. And it wasn't until I discovered William Gibson, Neuromancer and Burning Chrome, that it suddenly all made sense, and I saw what you could do. I saw, you know, the used and battered future, the, you know, the characters who weren't brave Starfleet officers, they were just people trying to get by on the street. And I think, you know, you can probably, in some of the stuff I've written, see both those influences, but definitely I would say William Gibson, from that point of view, has been the biggest influence on my writing.
Yeah, now that I think about it, with the whole jailware situation in the Macat books, yes, I can totally see that. But out of interest, how much do you assume your readers know about science and technology? Like, obviously you were saying earlier about how you want to make sure your readers understand they're getting science fiction, but there's some quite wondrous bits of tech for your readers to get their heads around, like the aforementioned jailware.
I'm very lucky. My wife reads all my first drafts and comments on them, and she's not kind of a science fiction reader by choice. So she won't let me get away with any of the kind of shorthand of science fiction. So if I write, you know, about, oh, they flew over to a Dyson sphere, she'll say, what's a Dyson sphere? And then I'll have to explain it to her. And then I think, well, if I have to explain it to her, then I better put an explanation in the book, you see. So she doesn't let me get away with just taking anything for granted. So I try to not exhaustively explain like a textbook what things are, but at least give enough of a hint or show them working so that anyone reading can think, oh, that's what it does, and get the idea that way. So I remember, I learned a lot growing up reading science fiction about various bits of technology and bits of fictional technology as well, like Ansibles and faster than light drives and how, you know, all the stuff, you know, like you can't jump into hyperspace too close to a planet or something, all this stuff that seems to be sort of accepted lore. So I tried to do that in my books as well. And the stuff with the gelware, I never explain actually what it's made of or all of that, because, you know, well, life's too short, really. I mean, nobody wants a great big treatise on this synthetic plastic processing stuff. But I just show what it does. And the name gelware, it's kind of quite suggestive of, you know, what it is. So, I don't assume anybody knows too much about how these things work or that anyone wants to know too much about these things. How these things work, as long as, you know, these devices serve the story. And I think, you know, I think in those books, gelware plays, I had to invent it because it plays an absolutely pivotal role in everything that happens.
Obviously, the Akak Maket universe, it starts from an alternative history. What made you think of going that kind of route, that obviously the history of the world is different to our own?
Well, actually, I saw a few years ago, there was an article in The Guardian, I think it's still online, and under the sort of Freedom of Information 30 years or how many years it is rule, some documents had been declassified that showed in the late 50s that the scenario that I use in the novel almost happened, that France did come to the UK, was facing economic trouble at home, was facing political problems abroad, there was a Suez crisis and all of that, did come to the UK and propose a political merger between the two countries with the Queen as the head of state for both countries. You know, you've got to remember this was only 10 or so years after the Second World War. France had been absolutely hammered in that. Both countries, you know, economically a bit rocky. And the British basically just turned them down. But I just thought, you know, how amazing that would have been, how different Europe would have been if they had just said yes instead of no. And in the book, I used the Suez crisis as the sort of turning point. And whereas in reality, Britain and France lost the Suez crisis, or, you know, basically were abandoned their campaign there. In the book, the world of the book, they won. They beat Egypt, and they won. And that victory, which would have really, really pissed off the Americans, I think, was enough to drive the two countries close enough together to undertake this merger. And so the Europe that we find ourselves in the story, which is 100 years later, is very different. And the power resides between London and Paris, rather than today where we are, where it's between Paris and sort of Brussels and Berlin. So it's just quite different. And I sort of played with the all the different ways things could have gone there, from, you know, the different history of the Beatles to, you know, different slang and so forth.
One last question, if you wouldn't mind. Do you have any comments about the recent reaction and subsequent withdrawal of Jonathan Ross from sort of hosting the Hugo Awards? Like, do you think that perhaps it could have set back science fiction and fantasy publishing in the UK?
Everyone involved in that debate had their reasons. Both sides had good points. I think it was just a shame how the whole thing happened. I think it happened very publicly. B, a lot of people were emotionally hurt and offended on both sides of the argument. And I don't think anybody came out of it looking particularly good. And I think, unfortunately, while the objections raised were done with the best possible motives, I think, the subsequent kind of slanging matches that erupted on Twitter between various people, you know, even people not even sort of centrally involved in the debate were arguing about it, and, you know, it spawned lots and lots of other little arguments and went on. And I don't think it made science fiction look that good. And I think it was a real shame, and I think it was a shame it kind of became so divisive. And I think it's a shame that the issues, which were, both sides had valid issues, and it's a shame we couldn't have had a more reasoned and informed and rational debate rather than kind of an online screaming match, which unfortunately, in a lot of cases, is what it was degenerating into.
No, that's fair. That's actually how the Nerds Assemble team felt when we were discussing it a few weeks ago. Just wanted to get somebody else's perspective. on the whole thing. Some DLC from, well, I mean, it would be nice to think that you'd be sort of nominated for a Hugo, and you'd obviously, you know, have a suitable host for the event, certainly. So yeah,
I understand that Jonathan Ross is quite a divisive figure, but at the same time, you know, he's got 500,000 Twitter followers, and somebody with 500,000 Twitter followers live tweeting the Hugo Awards would have brought it to an audience beyond anything it's had before. But, you know, it's as I say, it's just a shame. Things turned out the way they did, and it's a shame that it wasn't handled better on both sides.
All right. Well, thank you, Gareth, for your time.
Well, that's all we've got time for this episode. So it's goodbye from.
It's good night from me, Paul Wood. I'm Retroid on Eurogamer.net and Super Retroid on Twitter.
It's good night from me, Paul Blair, and I'm on Twitter as Paul Blair.
It's good night from me, Emily King. I'm on Twitter as EK6891. You can also find Nerdassemble over at www.nerdassemble.co.uk. We're also available on iTunes. We're on Twitter as Nerds Podcast. Plus, we're on Facebook and Google Plus as Nerdassemble Podcast. Don't forget to check out hexdimension.com, especially because you want to read that Sorcerer retrospective once it finally goes live.
Among other ass.
Oh, another cool stuff as well.
Oh, we are generally kind of looking for content creators as well, so if you happen to have a passion for film, TV, comics, graphic novels, video games, board games, books. D&D, books, anything like that, then kind of visit us and,
Badgers. Contact us.
Badgers?
You really like badgers.
Do we have a badgers category?
What kind of badgers?
Do we have a badgers category?
I think badger sections are generally indicated for.
They are, yeah. I'm sorry, we don't have anything for badgers if, you know, you're really into badgers, but then it depends on how you're into badgers. That'd be...
Oh, you know what? I'm just going to say goodnight.
Yeah, it's probably better.
Goodnight.
Goodnight.
Badger, 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 mushroom, mushroom!